Hey, Rob B here with Rob D, and we've got a very special episode for you this week. We're bringing on a property expert with decades of experience, not just as an investor, but also as a mortgage broker. But what makes this episode really special is that she will guide you through how you should be acting right now in this boom market when it comes to mortgages. And if you follow her advice, you'll be well set up for this property boom.
Welcome to the Property Podcast, where every Thursday morning, property investors come to be informed and inspired. Today, we're playing a conversation that I had recently, which is one of the best conversations I've had in a long time, apart from with you, of course, Rob.
Hey, I was going to say.
There is so much interesting stuff in there, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening into it. And make sure you stick around to the end, because in Hub Extra, we've got a couple of ideas that are going to enhance your reading experience.
So this week on the Property Podcast, we're very lucky to have Lisa Orme on as a guest. Lisa is a property investor and has been a mortgage broker for many years. Now, in this episode, we wanted to follow on from a couple of weeks back where we looked at buying at the top of the property market. And part of buying is getting a mortgage. And we're in a really interesting time in the market cycle right now. It's an exciting time if you're investing, but you need to be making good decisions around your mortgages and how to set yourself up. Now, Lisa is aware of how market cycles work. In this episode where she talks with Rob D, we really get into the type of mortgage products that you should be looking at right now and her views on the market as well. It's fascinating stuff, and it's great to bring someone on the show with so much experience. Now, Rob took a bit of a risk at the start and somehow got into discussing her age.
Talking to a lady about her age is never a good way to start an interview. But I remember when I got into property, which must have been about 12 years ago, I was reading loads of your posts on Property Tribes, or I think it may even been called something else back then. Back then, you were very experienced even then, so clearly you're even more experienced now. So you've seen lots of changes in property and different points in the market cycle and everything else. Where we are now, does it remind you of any particular point in the past? Is this like anything that you've seen before?
It's definitely a hot market, that's for sure. It's definitely being fueled by the stamp duty holiday and various other things, which no doubt we'll come on to. Personally, I think it's about creating inflation. The way that you erode debt over time is to have massive inflation. And so I think there's definitely an underlying thing about eroding debt through almost false inflation, really, in the property market. I think also the property market, so many other businesses and industries rely on the property market. And you can even think about, you know, cars. Okay, you think, well, how does that affect the rely on the property market? Well, if the fact is if people are feeling wealthy because they've got equity in their home, they will withdraw that equity and they will go and buy a car with it, or they will buy a caravan with it, or they'll buy a motorhome with it, or they'll book a holiday with it, you know, and then you've got the natural knock-on effect of, you know, your B&Q and your home bargains and all of these sort of things, all, you know, with people spending money on their home. And I think the lockdown has encouraged that as well, you know, with people wanting to spend a lot more money on their home. We've done the same. We did loads of work last year on our house. There's a general feeling of wanting to boost the economy. From that perspective, no, you know, in 20 odd years, I've not seen anything similar. Yes, I've seen hot markets, but for different reasons. So we all know sort of 2002 to 2007 was crazy hot, but that was caused by different factors. There was a lot of impact on us from America, and, you know, we all know there was basically a free-for-all in finance, you know, from sort of the 2000s onwards. Buy-to-let was hugely popular. That had come in sort of, you know, been made more popular sort of in the mid to late 90s. The lenders were all over buy-to-let. So there was a hot market, but for very different reasons. So I've not seen a market like this in over 20 years for the reasons that we've got now. And I've joked with a number of people that who'd have thought the success of an international, not even a national lockdown, would be Amazon, the obvious one, and the housing market. You know, it's just absolutely crazy. And when the lockdown first happened, you know, I was, you know, batting down the hatches, and I thought this is going to be like, you know, absolute disaster for the housing market and the mortgage market. God, you could not have predicted what ended up happening and the way that the market's gone crazy. And like I say, I think, You've definitely got a supply and demand issue. I think there's a lot of people living at home that have said, oh, no more, you know, living with the parents and that type of thing. You're naturally, with people being forced together, I think divorces, separations, things like that have gone through the roof. So you're going to get one household becoming two. So you're going to get a natural supply and demand issue. But I do think that it's a lot of it has been falsely fueled to keep that market buoyant because of the knock-on effect and to create inflation over the next year or two to hopefully erode some of the massive debt that's going to be as a result.
It ties into a lot, something we've talked about a lot, which is sort of the macro stuff and the debt, the inflation, QE, all that kind of thing, which seems to be when everyone was kind of looking and all the kind of the consensus forecast, I think, was prices would fall by 10% or so as a result of COVID and everything else. It's easy to think that if you kind of just kind of look at the people's behaviour and fear and things like that. But then when you look at the bigger picture, it's like, well, actually, there's a lot going on here to pump up assets. And it suits a lot of people, the government included, and a lot of other powerful people for that to happen. So now the question is, okay, well, how long can this continue for? This is something that when prices started picking up, instead of plummeting like they were supposed to, it was like, oh, well, when furlough ends, this won't carry on. When this happens. Well, we still haven't really got to the end of furlough, but the market is still looking very resilient. So how long do you think this could go on for? Is this a temporary blip or the start of something more sustained?
I think the first hurdle, if you want to call it a hurdle, will probably be the end of the stamp duty holiday. I think the first thing is that we may see a little bit of heat coming out of the market. I think that's, I still think it's going to be very sustainable for a while, but I think we might see some of that crazy heat go out of the market end of June and then end of September when the second one goes. I certainly can't see them extending it again. The big criticism last time was that it was going to be like a cliff edge with just stopping the stamp duty holiday. Well, they've prevented that this time by just reducing the amount that you can you're going to get your discount on. So they've stopped that sort of cliff edge approach already. So I can't see them extending it. Also, the predictions for the economy are, you know, they said it was going to be about 5% growth in 21 into 22. They're now predicting 7 to 8% growth. So already you can see that there's going to be this real sort of bounce back boom after COVID. So there's no way they're going to want to fuel that even further. Yes, inflation helps, but they won't want it to go too far because the, you know, to control that then means increasing interest rates, and that is the last thing that they're going to want to do, is increase interest rates. So that affects government borrowing, which is massive, so they ain't going to want to do that. And then obviously everybody will then start to pull back and we'd end up going into recession. So that's the last thing that they're going to want to do. So I think we'll see a slight cooling into July. And then the back end of the year, we'll probably see a slight cooling again. And it does tend to cool off as we get into the winter months again. But I think it's going to be fairly sustainable over the next year or so. The government have got this, I say government-backed, but it isn't a government-backed scheme as such. It's just that they're backing the banks from any losses with offering the 95% mortgages. Not all banks have entered into it. It tends to be the primary banks. But a lot of the smaller banks are actually offering their own 95% mortgages anyway, just to sort of compete with that marketplace. So while people only have to put in a 5% deposit and the banks are confident about that because they've got some backing from the government, then that's going to continue to fuel the market, certainly at the bottom end. And if people can get onto the property market at the bottom end, so we've still got lots of investors coming in. We've now got the first-time buyer market, which is typically going to be that. As long as it's your main home, you can also move and use these schemes. It's not aimed just at first-time buyers. So it's going to keep that movement going in the marketplace for the next year or two. I think the interesting thing is what might fuel the next crash or recession, because we don't often see these things coming. You know, very, very few people saw 2007, 2008 crash. Only a couple of people predicted it. But invariably, there will be something. You know, it's just cycles. It's just what naturally happens. And I think it's really interesting to, if something like a worldwide pandemic doesn't cause a property crash, you have to wonder what's coming down the road, what's going to fuel that next one. And it may just be a more of a neutrality. I think that's probably what we've had for the last sort of 10 to 12 years or so, is actually more stagnation than anything. And that's allowed, you know, prices in some areas. I've even seen people saying that they're still selling houses now at the same price they bought them for sort of 10, 15 years ago in some areas, because it was so overheated, particularly amongst the property investor sort of end of the market in some places. So we may just get a stagnation and we don't get a crash, you know, a big almighty crash. But it'll be interesting to see what actually causes that. Like I say, if a worldwide pandemic doesn't cause one, it's going to need something pretty dramatic.
You mentioned interest rates earlier, and my best guess for what could cause it would be inflation getting out of hand to a point where it can't be ignored anymore. Then you've got to put rates up. And then obviously going from where we are now, it doesn't take much of a movement to like have a real effect on capital values. And then everyone starts going, oh my goodness, why are we paying so much for all this stuff? And there you go. And the contagion kicks in. But like you said earlier, that is, the government will be aware of this. Then they're going to know what will happen if interest rates do go up. It's almost like they're stuck at zero now, and they've got, they're sort of painting themselves into a corner, and they know that putting them up will be a disaster. So they're not going to do it until they have to, but at some point, surely it's got to happen.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and it'll be interesting to see how quickly they do it. Like you say, to control inflation, normally it's quite quick and, you know, short, sharp shock sort of approach. But it really would tip an awful lot of people over the edge, and particularly those getting into the market at 95%. You know, they've got just nowhere to go. Quite often at the top end of affordability mortgage-wise, by the time they've covered all the costs and everything, they probably wouldn't be able to bail out of the property and sell, let alone if you have a dip, which is the precise reason why the government's backing the lenders on this. So I can't see the government backing lenders at 95% if they had any intentions of having to basically pay out on that, which means they clearly believe that interest rates are going to stay low, because even a 0.25%, 0.5% could tip. That would be a doubling of interest rates, effectively, the base rate, obviously not your mortgage rate. But if you're at 95%, you're a first-time buyer and you've put everything, all your affordability into a mortgage, then the government have to know that that would just tip them over the edge. So they clearly have no intentions of increasing rates anytime soon until that the marketplace has way surpassed that 5% margin that they've got in there. So I think that could give us some confidence that the interest rates aren't going anywhere fast. I think what they'll do is, the thing is to keep an eye on the newspapers. Without a doubt, the government uses the media to control us, the people, without a doubt. And it's very, very apparent with things like, you know, house prices. Oh, your house is going up at £100 a day. Everybody goes, woo, whoopee, off they go to B&Q and spend their money, or they buy a new car. And the next thing you'll see, you know, house prices predicted to crash, interest rates likely to go up. Everybody, you know, pulls back and stops their spending without them having to do anything. So the media is a really good sort of advance warning that unless we hold back, we may see them have to do something, you know, more proactive. So keep an eye on the headlines. As long as we're seeing, you know, your house price is going up at X pound a day or whatever, they're fairly confident. As soon as they start to get less confident, we'll start to see the headlines turn and then start, you know, warning us through the press that we're going to see, you know, interest rates rocket and house prices crash. And that's the time that hopefully, you know, the herd mentality will kick in and people will hold back a little bit and they won't have to actually do it. But I think we could be looking at another 10 years before we see any real increase in rates. We might see, you know, 0.25% here, then drop back down again just to control things a little bit. But, you know, back to sort of 4%, 5%, 6% rates, I don't think we're going to see that for another decade. So they couldn't afford to.
So if we relate this back to mortgages, we'd say we've got some number of years until the market takes its next tumble, because we know it's going to at some point. It's just a matter of when. And you've said we're okay for like the next year, maybe more. Fred Harrison, did the 18-year property cycle and was one of the few people who predicted the last crash, and I think the one before that, says 2026 is when it's going to happen. So that gives us 5 years. But sort of assuming that you're looking at some number of years, how should you be playing the mortgage market at the moment. So if we start out looking at it from the perspective of someone who's maybe got their own home and maybe one buy to let and they're looking at expanding, what should they be doing? Should they be being cautious in terms of loan to value? Should they be sort of maxing it out while they can because that loan to value is going to decrease over time? How would you look at it?
Well, it's interesting that in buy to let, even with the confidence in the market, realistically, buy to let is still at 75% loan to value. There's the odd lender at sort of 80, you know, it's expensive. I think there's one or two at 85 and that's very expensive. So 75% is really where it's at. And to put in that 5 or 10% less is costing you so much more money that it just doesn't make financial sense to do it. So there's clearly still some caution in the buy-to-let market. And I think a lot of that's probably to do with Section 24, really, the, you know, not being able to offset your mortgage interest relief because landlords just simply aren't making as much profit as they were. They've got more tax to pay. And again, you know, that will send some people over the edge and some people having to sell. It's only last year that it's now kicked in full. So this year, with the tax bills, is really the first year that landlords are really going to see the full impact of Section 24. So I think lenders are going to want to hold off for a year or so to see the impact of that if it knocks onto sort of repossessions or fire sales and before they get any confidence back. And I think by that time, we may see a cooling in the market that they're happy to stick around that 75%. So I think if you're sensible and you're looking at 75% market, because that's where the better rates definitely are, you're definitely factoring a good cushion there of comfort that worst case scenario, you should be able to bail out and get your money out. So even when we've seen big property crashes, we can talk about 10%, 20%, that type of thing. But for individual properties, they don't tend to drop by 25%. So worst case scenario, most people should be able to bail out if they had to, might end up losing a bit of money in stamp duty and all of that they had to pay when they bought the property. But again, I think at 75%, I don't think we'll see any sort of disasters in the market. When we had 07, 08, like I say, it was a free-for-all in finance in the previous sort of 5-6 years to that. You know, people were doing instant refinances, effectively 100% finance. You had lots and lots of lenders comfortably offering 85% mortgages, even 90% mortgages back then. So there just wasn't that cushion to go if we had the crash. And then obviously that's what did happen. So this time the lenders are being a lot more cautious, even, you know, back-to-back sales and all of this lot still haven't come back into the market. You've got lenders that are comfortable doing instant refinances or day one remortgages, but at 75%, typically against your purchase price or with uplifting value evidence of works, the old MX days and that type of thing, as you know, have not returned, which I think is a really, really good thing. The lenders learned their lesson from what happened. And yes, it's frustrating for investors. And, you know, they see people, you know, who built large portfolios, myself included, you know, during that crazy time. But also an awful lot of people went bust, lost, you know, buy to let properties or lost their homes. And we don't want to be seeing a repeat of that. It's not good for anybody. It's frustrating as it might be for an individual person saying, well, you know, why can't I get something with only a 10% deposit, buy to let or do back to back? It is not good for everybody when we have a crash. And certainly when the banks withdraw from lending. And that was the big thing back then, is it was just such a stagnant market. You know, any investor will say you make money, you know, in an up market or a down market. A stagnant market is just the pits. It really is. Just nothing moving at all. Nobody wanting to move. Everybody sitting tight and the lenders not lending because they've lost so much money. That's the last thing we want. Up market's fine, down market's fine, stagnant market, no, don't want that.
Something that investors are always worried about is negative equity. Everyone's terrified of negative equity. Even if you don't get into negative equity, even if, say, you start at 75%, but then the value of your property falls, so you end up with like effectively 90% loan to value. What happens in that situation? How afraid should investors be of that happening? Because clearly you're not going to have many options if that is the case.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry about it too much. Time is a great healer for a lot of things. And as long as the property's paying for itself, so that's getting your numbers right in the first place, then even if we have a dip or a crash, you know, a full-blown crash, if you just sit it out and wait, eventually it will catch up. And like I say, you know, I'm still seeing investors now that are selling properties for the same or less than they bought them for in the mid-2000s. But that's back to doing the research. If you're buying in areas, we all know sort of like parts of the North Midlands and the North where investors piled in, and you had terraced houses that for donkey's years have sold for £10,000 a pop, that because of investors piling in, and that's the only market that there was, were then paying £70,000, £80,000, £90,000 for properties that historically had sold for 10, 15, 20 grand. That has got to be a great big red warning flag. And similar now, you know, if something historically has been selling, let's increase the prices for 50, 60, 70,000 a pop for the last 20, 30, 50, 100 years, and now you can't pick something up for less than 125, that would be a great big warning flag for me. You want to be looking for sort of consistent, steady growth over time, seeing, you know, going and checking Rightmove, checking the comparables, seeing that over time, yes, house prices have steadily crept upwards in that area. And importantly, that there's a lot of ordinary buyers, residential buyers, that it's not solely being fueled by investors. That's, again, a big warning flag. So I think as long as you've had in the area that you've chosen or where you buy in, there's been steady growth over a long period of time, that it's not exclusively investors, and that the property pays for itself, then sit tight and it will recover over time. And you will see that, you know, the property prices come back. It's when you're forced into selling and it's a fire sale, if the property doesn't cover for itself, if you've got bad tenants, if you've gone for HMOs, for example, they're very saturated in some areas. Loads of people have jumped into HMOs over the last 10 years or so. So if you've suddenly got a six-room HMO and you're struggling to fill the rooms, then you're going to feel like you're going to have to sell and then might end up in a fire sale situation. We're seeing a lot of people doing serviced accommodation, holiday lets, the sort of charitable, you know, asylum seekers, the Serco, the rehousing offenders, you know, substance abusers, all of this type of thing. They're all seen as a bit easy money at the moment. And the danger comes with these is that you've targeted a particular area, a particular tenant type. And then when the bottom falls out of that, all of a sudden you can't rent your property and then you're forced into the fire sale. If you want to try these things out, fine, but will this property let to Mr. and Mrs. Smith every day of the week? You know, family, couples, singles, that's your base market. That's where you need to be looking. If you want to do the other things and make a bit of money, but come back to the fundamental basis of letting, and will it let to ordinary people, ordinary folks, and sell to ordinary people and ordinary folks every single day of the week? If it will, just ride it out.
Something that I would be concerned about is, even if the rent's being paid, if you get to a situation where the value of your property has fallen so you can't move away to another lender, you're going to end up stuck on an SVR, which might not be very attractive. But I suppose that's the benefit of the stress tests that have come in, which are very annoying in some respects, but actually kind of helpful, because it means that even if you were stuck on an SVR, unless something goes crazy with interest rates, then you're still going to, the property is still going to pay for itself and you can keep it ticking over until things normalize.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, some of the reversion rates are still very high in comparison to the actual interest rates you're paying. So, you know, a lot of people are doing limited companies and things like that at the moment. 5-year fix in sort of mid threes is about where it's at. But reversion rates are fours, fives, even mid sixes. So if you do end up going onto that reversion rate, it can really sting. Basically, it could, you know, double your mortgage payments. I put a post on Facebook recently saying I was just selling a property and dug out some old paperwork. And my interest rate on my mortgage at the time was 6.99 and the reversion rate was 9 point some odd. There is so many people that just would not be able to cope with those sort of rates at the moment. And I'm even seeing people complain, you know, when the rates start at a 2, is there anything less? You know, it's just absolutely crazy. And I'm just like, we're not even talking like, you know, the 1970s or anything. You know, we're only talking, you know, in the 2000s, mid-2000s, that we were talking about these sort of interest rates. So people really need to be, like you say, the ICR, the lender's stress coverage, it is making people borrow less, but it is causing a bit of a problem with people that need to come and remortgage where they've had the old 125% at sort of 4.99, and they're finding that it's a lot tougher, particularly if they're a higher rate taxpayer, particularly if the properties are in their own name, than some of the ICRs that aren't even covering the old mortgages that they've already got. So you do need to be careful with that. But if for new mortgages, then the ICR is giving again that cushion that people have to have, which is why people need to be really careful about trying to get round these ICR coverages. And this goes for the lenders as well. You know, that if you take a longer term fix, we'll give you a lower coverage rate. If it's in a limited company, we'll give you a lower coverage rate. If you're a lower rate taxpayer, we'll give you a lower coverage rate. You've still got to be really careful with these. And I would be doing my own sums on the basis of interest rates being sort of 6% or something like that, and not just relying on the banks finding these wheezes to get around to lend you more money. That's what they're in the business of doing, is to lend you more money. You need to be careful yourself on making sure that you've got your own coverage and that you would be comfortable if interest rates hit 5-6%. And that's not talking about base rate. We're not saying if base rate goes another 5% from where it is, we're talking about mortgage rates. And if the base rate goes up 1% and you're already on 3.5 now, your interest rate is going to go 4.5 to 5 on your mortgage, if not higher, because the lenders will want more of a margin the higher rates go. So make sure you do your own stress tests and make sure that you're comfortable with, if rates go up, where you could be, or check out what the SVR is with the lender. Can you afford it if you end up on the SVR and you can't go anywhere else? I am a massive fan of long-term fixes. If we have a client, as you will know, if somebody says, oh, I want a two-year fix, I'm like, why? You know, I want to know why somebody wants a shorter-term fix. Now, if they say, I might not keep it, I might want to sell, I might want to convert it, I might want to switch it to a HMO, those are all great reasons for thinking about why you might want to take something shorter. For me personally, if I could have my entire portfolio on 20 or 30 year fixes, I would, for an increase in rates, I would bite the lender's hands off. But they're not typically available, particularly for sort of portfolio landlords. So for me, take the long-term fix if you're not intending to sell. And even if you do, okay, nobody wants to be paying a redemption penalty, but you know, 1-3% typically is where most of the redemption penalties are at, maybe 5 at worst. That's on your loan amount, not the purchase price. So if you're buying at 75%, that margin should still be in there. But if you were forced to sell, you could bail out of that property. So take the long-term fix and lock in exactly what you're going to be paying so that you've got more growth, more increase in rent over that time. But also check what the lender's SVR is and run your calculations and check that you could still survive. If you can't, don't buy it.
I love a long-term fix. I did a 10-year a couple of months back. I just felt such a wonderful kind of zen calm afterwards. I was like, oh, I'm so glad I have to think about this. I wish I could just do it with everything. But I think a view that some people will have, though, is wanting to do more capital raising. So if you are in a market where you think it's going to go up by 7-8% a year, and maybe you're buying at a bit of a discount, and then you think, well, in a couple of years' time, I could be pulling more money out of this. So is there an argument for doing a shorter fix in that scenario?
There is. I can understand that. I think what I'd be doing is saying which lenders have the option of taking further advances. The downside with the specialist market, which is where your portfolio landlords are, your limited companies, is a lot of those lenders don't get the money from the savers like banks do, and they get them from funding lines, which are very fixed, and therefore they don't offer further advance facilities. So a lot of the specialist lenders just simply don't offer further advances, also don't offer product transfers as well, a lot of them, which is really interesting. So when you come to the end of your five-year fix, it's not as simple as staying with the same lender and saying, well, what else have they got available? Now, that may change. A lot of the ones that started out as more specialist lenders with funding lines have turned to banks. So they've got banking licenses and therefore attract savers, then can offer things like product transfers and further advances. So none of us can predict that none of these banks can do it in the future, but we have to look at what's available now. And there is definitely less choice, but it's like everything, it is a choice. So if your priority is product transfers or further advances, then you simply need to use a different lender. The downside is that that could go the opposite way, and a bank that's currently offering further advances in 3 years' time doesn't. So we can all only go on what's available now. But if you like the idea of a long-term fix but think, I want to probably be pulling some money out, then opt for a bank or have that discussion with your mortgage advisor. Does this bank presently offer further advances? If you don't want to take a chance that they won't in a couple of years, then yes, you need to go for a shorter term. I think the downside, particularly with limited companies, is that the arrangement fees are still relatively high. And that's how the banks are keeping the rates lower. Is it's all swings and roundabouts, is the arrangement fees are relatively high. You know, the 1.5-2% is an unusual. So if you're paying out those fees every couple of years, that can really add a lot to your overall costs. And bear in mind, if you capitalise these each time, most people will add the fee to the loan, then do that a couple of times, possibly three times in a five-year period, two, and then again, as you go into sort of the sixth year, then you at 2% each time, that's adding 6% to the mortgage. And if the property hasn't gone up in value, you could find that the third time you come to do that, you can't even mortgage, or that there simply isn't enough rental cover there under the new stress tests. Like I say, I'm a big fan of long-term fixes anyway, just for that set and forget. But another reason is because of the relatively high fees that there are, particularly in the specialist lending sector. So just be careful about taking those short-term fixes, and maybe just take a view that, yeah, I'll sit and wait 5 years and then see what happens. And don't forget, with the stress coverage anyway, just because your house has gone up in value, particularly for single lets, doesn't guarantee that you can get more money out. So running those calculations now, if it's, oh, I'm convinced in 2 years' time I want to take more money out, okay, but what do you think the rent will be? If the rent isn't going to go up that much in 2 years' time, you probably can't pull out any more money anyway. So you'd have actually been better off on a five-year fix, because you're not simply not going to be able to pull out any more money based on the rental cover.
Thank you, Lisa, and thank you, Rob, for doing all the heavy lifting there. We've just had an amazing episode. It's so much value there. So many notes, I'm sure, that you've been taking down, and action that you can put in place off the back of it. Well, I'm very pleased to say that next week, Lisa joins us again and brings just as much value to the podcast. So do not miss that episode. And we want to bring you more value before the episode finishes, because it's time for Hub Extra. And interestingly, this Hub Extra came about from producer Dan. And producer Dan was telling us about how he had a book that he wanted to read for a long, long time in Kindle, but it was massive. It was a massive book and he just couldn't pick it up. It was too intimidating. So he picked up the audio version. And by having the audio on and reading the book at the same time, he found it super effective, which then triggered something in me, because I've been looking into different ways to help dyslexic children, with my son being dyslexic, to help him absorb and read and really get to enjoy and love books as well. And there is a technology built by Amazon for this very thing. It's called immersion reading. And you don't have to be dyslexic to enjoy this. It's something that many of us can take advantage of. And what Amazon very cleverly does through a lot of their devices, not all devices though, so you do need to check device by device, is they do something called immersion reading. And immersion reading is what Dan has experienced, except that the text is highlighted as you go through it. So you listen to the audio and Amazon knows exactly where you're up to in that audio book, and then highlights it as you go. If your audio is sped up, the highlighting gets sped up. It's an amazing technology. And if you have dyslexia or know anybody else who has dyslexia, then please, please, please make them aware of this little known feature. It's absolutely fantastic. Well done, Amazon, for putting it together. And a further plug for Amazon, and I have no shares, is that their kids offering, their Kindle Unlimited, is very reasonably priced and allows you to access a load of books. So if your children just like reading in general and they want to get their hands on even more books, then check out Kindle Unlimited for children. It's an incredible offering.
Well, there you go. So much to take away from this week's episode, and next week is going to be another great one as well. So make sure you join us next Thursday morning, but you'll see us before then. We'll be here on Tuesday with Ask Rob and Rob. Until then, enjoy your week and we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.